Okay, I thought I'd start by telling you a story. So in 1980, Nigel Onwin and Ken Taylor and I built a cold stage, and we installed it in an old Philips EM300. And we thought, oh, we're going to do cryo microscopy. And we had no idea how to make a specimen, you know. We thought, well, we have to make a thin layer of ice. So we had some catalase platelets, and we put them on a grid, and we looked at the grid under a polarizing microscope, and we waited until the little speckles of light stopped moving, which indicated that the layer of water was getting thin, and then we plunged it in liquid nitrogen, stuck it in the microscope, and prayed. And we actually took that of that first grid that we ever made, we took a bunch of electron diffraction patterns, which extended to 1.8 angstroms resolution. So it was a very exciting evening. And I have to say, we couldn't reproduce it for 6 months. And in desperation, we left Stanford and we went to Berkeley to Bob's lab. And Jules Jaffe was working there at the time. And we said, please, Jules, show us how to make specimens. And they were making specimens by putting, sandwiching their catalase crystals, or actually it was purple membrane, between two layers of carbon. So you'd float one layer off onto the surface of water and you would pick that up, put the purple membrane on and then dunk it under the water again, pull up another layer, and the two layers would sort of squash out the liquid. And Jules described this to me and I said, okay, can I have a demonstration? So he said, okay, we have to go get the water. So he gets a container and he goes down the hall to the water fountain. And he gets the water from the water fountain. And I said, is this really necessary? He goes, oh, yeah, yeah, you have to get it from the water fountain. So I think specimen preparation has advanced a little from those days. And Holger is going to tell us all about it today.
Maybe it hasn't advanced so much. Yeah, I'm going to talk about sample preparation today. And just to give you a little motivation, because I don't think there is much of motivation necessary for this topic, but from a different perspective, what we did is we looked at the PDB entries. If you look at the PDB entries, you find interesting things. So you can look at the entire PDB database, and if you look for complexes, so this is now defined here as a minimum of four different chains, so just four different chains. A virus is not in there with one and the same chain. So four different chains, then you will see that only 1% of the PDB database has entries with complexes of more than four different chains. And that is in contrast to the fact that most proteins act together in complexes that are, on average, about 10 different chains. So and if you look at those entries that are present in the PDB database, then most of those come from complexes such as ribosomes, Gro-YEL, proteasomes, all those nice complexes that we know are well-behaved, soluble, stable, under all sorts of conditions. So they are all very pleasant to work with. But what about those large number of molecules that have several hundred kilodaltons or megadaltons in size, are asymmetric in the cell, and the structure is unknown, and why don't they crystallize? So people work on them. There's lots of crystallography labs working on complexes, and nevertheless, they usually have very low success rates when the number of chains exceeds three components or more. Then already the success in getting crystals, not even talking about diffraction, goes down. And so there must be a reason for that. Why complexes don't behave always the way they should behave or we like them to behave as a single molecule, as a single chain molecule, or whatever. And this is something we wanted to work on since we worked on many of these complexes. So is this a trivial question? It's also not a trivial question for EM. So even if you don't want to crystallize, as you see there, this is probably familiar to many of you. You have stronger tendencies of aggregation if you work with large complexes, or things fall apart. So it's very difficult to get images or complexes behave to get you really very nice images you could work with. So that is why we have now this term challenging complexes. And I would say there's a number of reasons why these complexes are challenging or more challenging than others. So one is the abundance, the sheer abundance in the copy numbers. If you just look at say, the most favorable EM objects like ribosomes, proteasome, GroEL, and so on, they are very highly abundant and they are very have very high copy numbers. And that makes them also very easy to purify. They're also very soluble. So they are, in that respect, well-behaved. And it's also very difficult to kill them. So it's, even for a ribosome, it's very difficult to disrupt it and to destroy it. So it's not so easy as people think. So maybe you should try and you will see it's not so easy. This is an important aspect, aggregation behavior. So so many of the complexes have, if you try to work with them, have a very strong tendency to aggregate, and that makes them also difficult to look at them in the microscope, obviously. And then you can define it as basically two problems that we usually are facing. This is called the structural heterogeneity. So you may damage your molecules already when you isolate them. So you may lose a certain component, or some of the complexes may have another component bound to them, causing some kind of problems to the structure of the complex already at that level during purification. And you may have this conformational heterogeneity that is that you just don't know what kind of changes, conformational changes, is this complex undergoing through the functional cycle. And are you really sure that you have trapped it in one specific conformation, or are there many more conformations present in solution? So I will more focus on the structural heterogeneity because this is where things get started. So this is the initial problem. And then the other system here, I will talk quickly at the end about this, how one can possibly try to improve the conformational heterogeneity of complexes. But this is the most annoying thing, and I think this is the most important issue why things don't work in many cases. So just to show you what I think is different between different complexes, I set up this scheme here where I looked at what's the abundance, stability, symmetry, and shape-size relationship. So this is more on the sample level. This is on the imaging level. This is on the image processing level. And what kind of structures can you get? And so if you look, this is what Hong did, and we know this is the world record that we have in resolution now. So the CPV virus from Hong's lab, this is very nicely abundant. It's a stable complex. It has high symmetry. It's a huge complex. It's easy to image. Hong, he does very well in getting high-resolution images of those viruses, and he's also doing extremely well in processing them to very high resolution. So this is the optimum scenario we all would like to have for all other systems as well. So if you look at, what happens to GroEL, GroEL is not at the same level of resolution, but it's almost as abundant, or it is highly abundant in the cell. It has a very high stability. The symmetry is lower. It's slightly smaller, so you have to maybe go to higher defocus value, which makes it slightly less easy to image it. And also, it may have some dynamical properties. So it's more difficult to process it. So and then you come up with slightly lower resolution. And if you look at the ribosome is also extremely highly abundant. It is very stable, probably at the level of GroEL. There's no symmetry at all, but it has a very nice shape, very nice size. In spite of having no symmetry, it gives you very high contrast in the electron microscope, so you have very good and easy time to image it. The processing is more demanding because it's more dynamic, more difficult to prepare it biochemically in a well-defined state. So the current resolution level of ribosomes is more in, for the best structures, is at this 5 to 6 angstrom resolution level. But nevertheless, in spite of the lack of symmetry, it's possible to get to relatively high resolution structures. So if you now look at another system where you have a very high abundance and stability and symmetry components. This is for ferritin, for example. But ferritin is a 440 kilodalton complex. And even though that it's very highly abundant, stable, has a very high symmetry, it's a bit small to image it in cryo, and it has some nasty behavior. So it has it's a spherical object, and there's no large things that protrude out of this spherical shape. So it's very difficult to process those images, very difficult to get nice images, and also to process the data. And so it's very difficult to get a high resolution structure of ferritin. I even don't know anyone, maybe you have seen some of, but I'm not aware that there is a high resolution cryo-EM structure of ferritin around. So you see, you may have a very good sample, but even then, the imaging and the processing is becoming really problematic, and you even having a good sample, you don't get a very good structure. So, but what we are working mostly is those complexes like the spliceosome, for example, which are really very low abundant. They are very fragile. They have no symmetry. The only thing is they are big, so you can actually image them. They are large enough to do to record cryo images. The processing is possible. They are big, but since they are relatively heterogeneous, it's also much more demanding than it is for ribosomes. And in total, the resolutions you can get is really much lower than what we can do for any of the other systems. So this is a problem, because I think we have, and the whole workshop will deal with all those issues here on imaging, how you can improve the imaging, what best microscope, what's the best detector you can get, and processing is also, of course, extremely important, but you can't solve those problems in green here for us. Well, you can't solve them by imaging and processing alone. So this is really something that needs to be improved on the biochemical level before we can really expect to have higher resolution structures. And this is what we are working on for the last decade in order to figure out what we can do, what is needed to make those complexes feel more happy, be really structurally stable and well-defined. And this is a component of the spliceosome. This is the U4, U6, U5 trisnurb. And we started working on this complex many, many years ago. And if you get a sample of that and you just prepare it in negative stain, this is how they basically looked like. And you see exactly what you probably also know, what you have seen many times before, looking at such kind of complexes. There's broken parts, there's aggregates, there's basically everything. There's a whole continuum of different size ranges, and certainly absolutely impossible to do any image analysis with that. And you can have the best microscope and the best detector. It really won't help you. But what we did then with this sample is we just tried what happens when we add to the same solution, when we add some fixative, and then prepare it for negative stain. So this is just a normal negative stain grid on a silicon carbon layer. And if we just fix the sample just before we bind the complexes to the carbon film, this is what we got. So in fact, it wasn't that bad. So we created these problems partially on our own side. So and that is true for, I think, many of the complexes that are large and asymmetric and fragile like this here, that we have to work with them at very low concentrations because they are not as abundant. And the binding forces for the binding energies of the individual components of such a complex are probably not equally strong for all the components. And sometimes the binding forces to the carbon film may be stronger, and that may be just the reason why you can easily disrupt those complexes by binding them to a carbon support film. And then you usually blame the biochemists why they did this, and they didn't do it. So this is the reason why we then thought we may just try to look at this chemical stabilization in a more systematic way, and this is the reason why we developed this graphics method. For those who haven't heard it, this is the name comes from a combination of gradient centrifugation and simultaneous fixation. So how we do that is that we have a normal centrifugation tube, and we prepare a glycerol gradient or any other sugar solution gradient. And in addition to that, we have a fixation gradient. So we add a fixative only to the heavy salt, heavy sugar solution, and by mixing the gradient, you get the sugar gradient in addition to the fixation reagent gradient. And that means when you apply your sample onto the gradient, when you start a centrifuge, it doesn't see lots of the fixation reagent. It only sees it later on while it's moving down the centrifuge tube and gets fixed in a later or stabilized in a later stage. And what we then do is after the centrifugation run, we just pump the tubes out, and then you have samples that you can either apply directly to prepare negative stinkrets. This is what you have just seen in the recent in the image before. Then they are more stable. They usually survive the binding to carbon films, and you can make sure that it's not the biochemistry is wrong if something fails, but it's really the integrity of the complex that is not yet optimized. And you can do some buffer exchange to get rid of the glycerol using buffer exchange columns. And usually the complexes do survive that, while they normally don't survive that if you haven't done the fixation. So many of our complexes that we work with, you can't use gel filtration columns. They will die immediately. You will have fragments, aggregates, whatever, but you won't have an intact complex anymore when you apply gel filtration columns to a non-fixed spliceosome, for example. This is impossible. And by removing the sugar, you can then prepare cryo-EM grids the very same way like you do negative stain grids. So we usually use carbon films to allow binding of the complexes to the carbon films. And the reason why we do that is because we are low in concentration, and we simply don't have enough material to do normal cryo without carbon film. I come back to that in a minute. So this is one test for the spliceosome that we did. So this is a normal gradient, and you see there are particles, but there's also broken fragments everywhere. And if we look at the fixed sample here, the stabilized sample, then we don't see that anymore. So we have just intact particles, and there's no broken stuff that floats around and binds to the film.
Could you go back to the previous slide?
Yeah.
Why do you need the fixation gradient? And the glycerol gradient. Glycerol keeps it as a zone, right?
Yeah, the glycerol gradient is a purification method. Yeah.
But the fixation gradient.
Yeah.
And so why? How long to centrifuge?
The problem is that if I go quickly back to that image, this here. So if you start with a sample that looks like that, or has a tendency to aggregate, which is true for many of the complexes, and you add the fixation reagent, what you will get is just fixed aggregates. So you can't do that. You cannot do the chemical fixation on something that has a tendency to aggregate. And since you don't know whether you can do that or not, we do it always this way, because what happens in a gradient centrifugation is that while the centrifuge is running, you have a pressure acting on the complexes. So the complexes feel pressure that is dependent on the speed of the centrifuge, and it's in the several tens of atmospheres that act on the complexes, and this is enough to disrupt this weak aggregation of the complexes. Mm-hmm. So you make sure by running these gradients that a molecule runs on its own and not as an aggregate. So mm-hmm. then only those that run on their own will see the fixation reagent as a monomer. And you make sure that in the peak fraction you will get somewhere here, you have only monomers that have seen the chemical fixation reagent. That's the reason why we do it. So just to prevent the fixation of aggregates. So this works very well for most of the cases we have looked at. So this is just a number of RNA processing related complexes. So you see this is the normal glycerol gradients if we run them without the chemical fixation, and then we apply the sample to negative stain. You see what happens here in this case, for example. You see there's lots of aggregates. So aggregates can also form again after you have stopped the glycerol gradient. So you can form them again, and then we will see them on the grid again. But if you have done that on the gradient, if you have changed this, what you do is when the glutaraldehyde reacts with the complex, it changes the surface charge of the complex, and it makes it less, it has a lower tendency to aggregate afterwards. And this is what we see for basically everything we have looked at. A complex that had a high tendency to aggregate at the beginning, after this treatment, doesn't have this anymore. This is, for example, the U2SNRB. The U2SNRB doesn't look. This is actually showing you an example. This is not a normal gradient centrifugation. This is a gradient fraction that was fixed after the gradient, and then applied to the carbon film. While this one here was fixed on the gradient, and this is also a clear difference. So you don't see that all the time. So if you do that same thing for a ribosome, no difference. But for certain complexes, it makes a big difference at what level and when do you do the fixation. And another thing is, this is this SMN complex here. There you see after the centrifugation run, the aggregates formed again. And if you have them fixed, the molecules, then they don't. They still have some tendency to aggregate. You can't avoid that completely, but you end up with something that you can work with. And one thing that we also found is, maybe you see that here, so for the editosome, which is something that is really very low abundant, so this is almost homeopathic, and we don't see, after normal binding, we don't see any particles in those grids. So 2 minutes binding of molecules doesn't give us anything on the grid. And what we did here is, after the graphics run, we then allowed them to bind overnight to the carbon film. And this gave us at least a decent particle concentration that we could work with. And then we checked that in more detail, that you can really, once you have these fixed samples, there's a different behavior in how particles bind and how many of them you can bind to the carbon film. So if you look at that, this is the spliceosomal complex, for example. And in red, you see the numbers of particles that we find on the grid when we allow them to bind for us. Increasing amount of time here. And the red is for the non-fixed, non-stabilized complexes, and the blue is for the fixed complexes. So, and you see that even if you allow binding for more than 2 hours and you have a non-fixed sample, there's no difference in population on the grid anymore. But you can increase the concentration steadily, and even overnight absorptions of your molecule make sense if you, in some cases, if you have a molecule that is really lowly abundant. And the same is true for this trisnr complex here. You see, it's the same behavior. So we can almost double the number of particles on the grid, even working with very low abundant complexes. And this is the reason why we also do that in cryo. So when we work in cryo, we always have a thin carbon film present, because we just don't get enough material for many of the complexes we're working with to image them in holes, but we can increase the concentration this way, just allowing them to bind to the carbon film for a longer time.
What protein concentration is being applied here?
What protein concentration? This is for these two complexes, and to get to this distribution of particles that you see, this corresponds to about 20 to 30 microgram per milliliter. So that's about the concentration range.
How do you accomplish such a long binding time without evaporating? What are the practical?
Oh yeah, I didn't mention that. We have blastic blocks where we drill in holes and we fill the sample solution into these holes, and then we float float off the carbon film, and just let the carbon film floating on top of the solution, and then we cover these plastic blocks and put them into the cold room overnight, so there's no evaporation. And the next day, you just take off the lid and take it up with your grid. He was first, you say.
If one of the effects of the fixation is to change the surface charge and so on,
yeah.
You know, that's presumably the hypothesis why this works. What about just controlling for the properties of the films, the repair films, and carbon films with different types of charging, hydrophobicity, and so on? Would that be an equivalent?
Yeah, you could do that, probably. We never work that way. So we work with carbon films that are on mica, and we use always we cut out a piece of mica with carbon film, and then we let it float on top of the on the solution. So it is always a freshly a fresh surface. Never. So in this way, we prepare it. There's no way we can treat it chemically in any way.
So the fact that you don't seem to reach a steady state, an end state, suggests that you're going from an equilibrium reaction to an actual irreversible reaction, that you're reacting with carbon. Do you clench it, or how do you explain that it just keeps absorbing?
I have actually no good explanation for that. So, but you certainly reach a limit. So it after... Usually, and it depends on the complex. It's not the same for all the complexes. So for some complexes, this doesn't work the same way. So then more than 3 hours doesn't make any sense. But some of them really increase steadily. I don't know the difference between those complexes. This is all surface physics, chemistry, very difficult to know what's going on.
How much mass do you add in your fixation? What fraction?
Yeah, so the concentration of the fixation reagent is very low, and we can't, by STEM, for example, we can't measure the difference between a fix and a... By mass spec, you can't... we haven't tried to let those complexes fly in the mass spec, so this is something we haven't tried yet. There is certainly a... But I come back to this point later, so that we don't have a complete fixation reaction, and I will show you later why that is the case. So that's the problem. So when you do this chemical reaction, then you end up with a complex that you can no longer analyze by SDS gel analysis. So if you use glutaldehyde, and we have tried different cross-linkers in the meantime, so glutaldehyde works best for most of the complexes. It doesn't work best for all complexes. So there's other cross-linkers that you may try that work better for other complexes. But the most versatile cross-linker we have seen so far is glutaldehyde. And but then you have a cross-link complex, and if you have that and you apply it to an SDS gel, you don't see your bends anymore. That means you don't know what you have in your hands, and you have no biochemical control of your proteins that are in the complex that you look at, and this is something you can overcome, because what we did is in collaboration with the mass spec lab by Henning Urlaub in Göttingen, we just allowed the particles to adsorb to a carbon film, similar to the way we prepare EM grids. Exactly the same way. And then we collect those carbon films and we put them into an Ebendorf tube, and we just try to digest them with trypsin. And if the complexes are not completely cross-linked, because glutaldehyde acts on the lysines that will be recognized by a trypsin to cut the protein, so if we have not a complete fixation reaction, then we should still be able to detect the fragments by mass spec, and this way we should be able to analyze the composition of the complexes. And this works actually extremely nicely. We can do that for all the complexes we look at, working at the concentration levels of the glutaldehyde we usually use. You can do this kind of analysis, and that means you cannot see it in your SDS chart, but you can see the fragments in the mass spec, and you can then correlate it to your complex. And it's actually a nice thing, because you can do it the same way you prepare the EM images. So you have the analytics of the complexes that you look at, because it's the same kind of initial preparation. And then we compared this technique to in-solution digestion. So if we do the same thing, this was done with GroEL, GroES, and so we prepared that. And if you look at the in-solution digestion and fragments that we get by mass spec, so here we have the color code is a frequency of detection. So we do this experiment 5 times, and only the red ones here are the peptides that we find in all 5 trials. So it just shows you the reproducibility of the mass spec and the sensitivity of the mass spec, whether you work in on particles that were digested from carbon film and were fixed, or whether you work in solution. And you see that we have a very nice coverage of all the peptides that are accessible to trypsin, even working with fixed complexes that should have a lot of glutaldehyde in there. Another thing we found is that if you look at the pattern of the peptides you see in those complexes, is that there is a preference to detect peptides for the fixed complexes that are located at the interface regions. And that is very clear because the glutaldehyde usually is attacks all the solvent-accessible lysines, and that it, way it cross-links most of those very easily, while it doesn't easily attack those lysines that are in interface regions. And this is something we can detect here. So if you look at this, this shows you the number of internally localized lysine residues, and there is a clear difference in the number of peptides that we find here when we work with the fixed samples in comparison to the in-solution digest. So there is some extra information even that you can gain from doing this kind of analysis. And you have this direct correlation of the mass spec and the structure determination because you look at the same samples. We also have looked at the number of peptides you find. So this shows you again in red, this was done on these Dreissner particles. So in red, these are all the Dreissner proteins that are known. So, and if you do the digestion in solution, you see that these red peptides that you should find in the complex are not found systematically always five times in all the five experiments if you do it in solution. But if you do it in this fixed approach on the carbon film, you see that most of the of these red dots here are found five times very significantly all the time. So we get a very good readout for our compositional homogeneity or whatever you call it using this kind of approach. It is more time consuming. It is more difficult than a normal SDS gel, but it gives you also some extra information. And you can analyze your cross-link complexes. So, and then obviously there is some concern that this fixation could create some kind of structural artifacts because you have a chemical reaction going on. We looked at ribosomes and SNRPs that we have studied both ways, so without fixation, with the fixation, at the level of resolutions we were working, we couldn't see any difference in the EM structure, so that was not there. But then what we also try to do is, and I think this is now new, so we try to look at ferritin, and because this crystallizes very easily and you can just buy it, it's a 440 kilodalton complex. This is just the asymmetric unit of the ferritin, and then we try to see whether we can crystallize a fixed protein and whether this is really amenable to structure determination by X-ray diffraction. And it actually is. So this is now what you see here is in red, this is the normal ferritin structure. And in yellow, you see this is the overlay in gold or yellow. This is the structure that we have determined for a cross-linked ferritin that has been crystallized and solved by X-ray crystallography. And you see hardly any difference. So the RMSD is in the less than one angstrom range. No, we don't see it yet in that structure, but we are still working on that, actually. So this data set was not complete. We think we should be able to see it at one point, but we haven't seen them here. We have just seen a difference in different B factors, so they are slightly different in certain locations, but so far we haven't seen any cross-linker. But we are sure that none of these complexes that went into the crystal was not cross-linked. So you can look at those that we have, those complexes that we've prepared, they all get stuck in the SDS page.
So I have a question about this specific sample. Did you do a mass spec on it? The question that I have is what fraction of the lysines were modified?
Yeah, good point. No, we haven't done it. As I said, we have not done any fly experiments of the whole complexes. So this is something we don't have in Göttingen. We can't do that locally. And I know Carol Robinson, for example, she's always busy. She could do that, and maybe we should contact her at one point to see whether she can see a difference and how much it will be. Yeah, no, good point. But we haven't done that yet. So what we can say is that this treatment, this chemical treatment, is not completely incompatible with crystallization even. So you can do that. It's a we don't have a complete fixation reaction. Otherwise, these lysines wouldn't be accessible to trypsin digestion. And those complexes behave well. You can crystallize them. Maybe not all. This is not something I would claim here. But you can do that. And the structures that we have determined are in the accuracy of the experiment are identical. So, but then one point is that this graphics reaction is something that is not able to repair any damage that you have in your sample before you start the experiment. So anything that you have damaged will not be repaired, and you have a lot of trouble if you have the wrong buffer or if you have already a very fragile complexes that has suffered some disintegration before you start this reaction. So you may still be able to select the fraction of intact complexes because the centrifugation is also a purification reaction, but you cannot make sure that your complexes are really intact. You can just make sure that the complexes that are intact remain intact for specimen preparation, and that is a difference. So what we're interested in over the last couple of years is how we can improve the situation in general. Is there a better way of isolating and purifying complexes and make sure that the environment for those complexes is better? Because as I said at the beginning, there's something crucial, something special for complexes. They need different environments, different purification procedures than normal single chain proteins. And you cannot apply simply all the techniques that are currently available and hope that your complex will survive those treatments. Why is that critical? It's critical. It's a very critical step because normally, I mean, you all know how it works. So if you try to get your hands on a complex, you give the project to a student. It takes them 3 years to come up with a protocol where you have a complex in your hands. You can look at it. And then he writes the thesis, and it's done. And you have a protocol, and you never know whether this is optimized or not. So whether you're in a local minimum or in wherever. You just have an idea that there is a complex and that it works to a certain extent. But what one should do afterwards is obviously to optimize the protocol. But this is very hard work and needs a lot of material. So if you do classical optimization, so if you try to do classical biochemistry on optimizing those complexes, it needs milligrams of material to figure out what's the best buffer, what's the best soil conditions, what's the best whatever. And it takes you years to improve the protocol. And this is obviously something you don't want to do, and nobody wants to do that, and that is probably also the reason why nobody does it. So it's very tedious, and you will never be able to screen the entire chemical space that you're interested in, so just for time reasons and material and whatever. So only a limited set of conditions will be accessible to classical biochemistry, in spite of the fact that nobody really does it. So, and an ideal optimization setup would be different. So the ideal optimization setup would be you need only small amounts of sample. The measurements should be highly sensitive. And it should have some high throughput character because you should be able to sample many, many different conditions at the same time. So this is what we would like to have, right? So you have complexes that are really low in abundance and you don't have the amounts and you need something more systematic to analyze the best conditions that stabilize your complexes. And it should use a very simple instrumentation and chemistry to do this kind of thing. And what we were looking at is a method that has been developed 6 years ago in 2006. And this is a method that is now being used by many crystallographers. It's called the thermoflow method. And this method is basically a method where you measure the thermal unfolding of a protein in a real-time PCR machine. So what you do is you just heat up your complex and you measure when it unfolds at which kind of temperature. That's the basic idea. And you do that in many different buffer conditions. If you have a good condition, it will melt at higher temperatures. If you have a bad temperature, a bad complex and a bad environment, it will melt already here at very low temperatures. So that's the idea, and you do that in a real-time PCR machine. So you have we use that machine, for example. So you have a 96 well blade, and you fill that up with your protein and all the different buffer conditions. You can screen all sorts of different conditions, different buffers, different pHs, different salts, different whatever. So you can vary all these things, and then you add a dye to it, and you heat it up in the real-time PCR machine and measure all these thermal unfolding curves. The dye we use is called Cypro Orange for our analysis. So this method is very sensitive. So it leads relatively little amounts. You can screen 96 conditions with about 1,000 picomoles. So that's about five to seven times more than you would apply for a normal graphics gradient. So it's not too much. It is highly sensitive. It has high throughput characteristics. And it uses simple instrumentation and chemistry. So it should work. But those people who have invented the technique, they have also stated that it won't work for complexes. It only works for single-chain proteins. And so why is that? So this is what normally happens. So when you have your protein in the real-time PCR machine and you heat it up, it's surrounded by this dye, cyber-orange. It's called a solvatochromatic dye. So the solvatochromatic dye changes its fluorescence when it's being exposed to a hydrophobic environment. So once the protein unfolds, the dye will see the hydrophobic side chains, and then the dye will become hyperfluorescent, and you see this increase in fluorescence. And if you heat that up even further, what happens then is that the protein will finally aggregate, and the dye will be again in solution, so the fluorescence will go down. So that's a typical curve that you will measure for a single-chain protein. And what the X-ray crystallographers are using is, as a characteristic, is the melting temperature. So that's the inflection point of this increase in fluorescence here in the curve. So they just look for the inflection point here and define the temperature at which the inflection point is as the melting temperature of the protein. And then they look for the thermal shift of the melting temperature depending on the conditions where the protein is in. So why does this not work for complexes? And this is a patented technique, and it's already stated in the patent that you can't do that for complexes, because then you have many components, and those components will probably unfold independently or not correlated well enough, and then you have multiple bumps and peaks and not a clear signal, and then you can't determine a clear melting point anymore. So that's the reason why it should not work for complexes. And we try to use that in spite of this thing. So this is what they have stated even in publications. So the relatively complex melting curves characteristics of multi-domain proteins currently preclude application of thermoflu to screening of these complexes. So just because of these difficult to interpret systems. So, and this is now, this is just to illustrate you how this looks like. So this is a complex, and you heat it up, and then it should unfold, and here it should aggregate, and normally you should have this clean curve, but if you have a complex, you may have many contributions at lower temperature, because some of the components may unfold at different temperatures. And so
if you have a single chain protein with multiple domains that have different melting curves,
it's the same, it could be the same thing. You could also get multiple transitions. No must. And then it doesn't work anymore. Because you need such a signal. This signal cannot be interpreted by the normal algorithm people use. And so what we're interested in is to see, we know that these things should happen, but can we define this unfolding reaction in a way, can we just model it in a way and describe it in a way that we can use a more complicated model to describe all the possible unfolding events, even for complexes. And so this is what David was working on here. So he's sitting here. So he has also a poster here. So if you have questions, you can ask him later at the poster also. So this is now the theory of the unfolding of complexes. And with this mathematics here, we just try now to interpret all the curves, and we can basically describe even the most complex unfolding events if you have multiple phase transitions and cooperativity effects and everything. So this is all included in the theory, and with this we can basically now try to measure the thermal unfolding of complexes and see what happens. And so we developed the software to do that now. So we measure these 96 unfolding events in the 96 well plate, and then we can put that into our software. It does the automatic fitting because we have the correct, hopefully correct, theoretical model to describe the unfolding, and then it extracts all the parameters that we think are needed to describe the stability of complexes in different solutions and in different buffer systems. And you basically just enter the result from the real-time PCR machine, and then the software does all this, and it ranks all the different conditions here, depending on some kinds of heuristic in terms of the parameters we think are important for getting the most stable conditions. And then you can also look at that they really look different. We can overlay those graphs. We can play around with this, and you can check what is the best condition that you have for your complex. And so just to show you a proof of principle, this is, for example, how this is a complex called cell B. It's involved in selenocysteine incorporation for the ribosome. It's a ring-like complex, and you see when we had that at this pH in an imidazole buffer at pH 5.4, and you measure the signal, it gives you this two-phase curve here. And we also see in the images, we see lots of aggregates and not so well defined structure. If we do the same thing and when we shift the pH to 6.6, you see that this first bump here is already getting lower, and the situation on the grid is already getting better. And if we go to a pH of 8, then we don't see any aggregates anymore, and we also get a very smooth curve as we would like to have it for a single chain protein. So this is just showing you that we can correlate the curves to the signals we see in looking at the complexes under different buffer conditions. This is now just an example. This is P97. So this is before the buffer optimization in the normal buffer system that people tend to use. And if you do it in the buffer that we determined after the optimization, then we see no aggregation anymore. So we see them as soluble and intact molecules. One of these questions in this abstract was also, can you add ligands or anything to your complex to help stabilizing them? You can actually do that, and you can even measure it with this technique. So this is looking at two different curves of the NFAs promoting complex with and without an inhibitor, EMI1. And just starting with the same amount of the sample and adding the inhibitor gave us a much better signal for the complex that had EMI1 bound. And we also see that there is, in the EM, that there is a massive improvement. The complex becomes more soluble. You have a larger concentration of the intact complexes on the grid, and we can then, because we have the full thermodynamic theory of the unfolding, we can also determine what is really getting better upon binding of the complex, and in this case it's the unfolding entropy as well as the unfolding enthalpy that is increased by binding of an inhibitor to the complex.
When you do the buffer optimization, do you routinely then use graphics to stabilize that complex?
Yes, we do both. So not always, but in most cases we combine it. And you know, I will show you an example that this is really helpful. This is another sample we have started looking at into. This is cohesin, and here you see that in red, this is under this black curve here, so it's actually this black red thing here, that's the reference structure. And if you add magnesium or ATP gamma S or magnesium ATP gamma S, you can also get a much better signal. So here you can directly get a readout for the stabilization of the cohesin by adding ATP gamma S to the system.
When do the curve start high?
Yeah, why it starts high? This is if you isolate these complexes with an antibody and you elute with a peptide, then you have a very high initial background because then the dye interacts with a peptide, and this will then be reduced by going to higher temperatures. But this is something we can still tolerate, and we take that into consideration. But it's not nice to have. So it would be better not to have that. Even also if you have aggregation, you partially see that here at the beginning, that if you have already aggregated complexes, you see that you start up here and then you first go down. So that is something, there's some content in there, there's some meaning behind this. This.
How do you know what buffer to use to purify the protein so that you can figure out which buffer to use?
Yeah, you start, it's an iterative process. You start somewhere. As I said, you have this PhD student, works 3 years to get somewhere, and then you start the optimization. Yeah.
So in the case that you're presenting, you're looking at a readout, you're looking at the correlation with the measure that you make. What's the estimation of the error? So where is significant? How can you tell that something is significant enough that actually you can predict now what's going to be the outcome in the...
Predict that you can't predict anything. So this is just we have no strict rules what can help stabilizing a complex and what can't.
But out of the measurement.
Out of the measurement.
So far.
We have this theory of how the complex unfolds, and there is this certain set of parameters that enter this formula. This is the unfolding entropy, the unfolding enthalpy. This is the cooperativity. This is the multi-phase transition of these curves. This is all this. Thermodynamics unfolding parameters that enter into the description of the curve, and those need to be optimized.
Given two curves,
yeah.
Where do you put the point where the two curves are significantly different so you can actually tell that this condition, a priori, without looking at the result, this condition is going to lead to a good result versus this condition? How different do they have to be?
On the EM grid, you mean?
On here?
This is hard to tell because it gives you all the parameters. You have to look at the parameters that can be extracted from this curve. So if you look at these curves just visually, you don't see as much as you get from the actual analysis of the curve fitting using all the unfolding parameters that we use. But here you see there is a thermal shift from this black to the blue, and that is maybe only a few Kelvin, but this is already significant. So this is something we have seen for many complexes, that a few Kelvin shift is already significant. But this is not the only parameter, you see. I mean, this thermal shift can be misleading because of if you have multiple unfolding events, then you don't see that really. So it's really the combination of all the parameters that makes a difference.
Do you have a standard set of 96 conditions?
Yes, yeah, we do, yeah. It's a buffer screen that we use. It's adapted from the Jena Bioscience pH head screen. And so it varies in pH down the rows, and it varies in the buffer on the long axis. So that's what we use. You can buy this screen, yeah. This is just to show you that we have done this measurements now for a number of complexes. So altogether, we have done 37 different complexes that we have looked at. Now, there's some bias of RNA binding complexes, but of course we were interested in getting an idea: is there the optimum stabilization procedure or the optimum buffer conditions that may work for all the complexes in the cell to the best extent? And then we didn't get that. So there's no such pattern what one would like to have, so that you have one magic buffer that does the job for all the complexes. it doesn't exist. And the only pattern we found so far is the pH pattern. So this is now looking at the pH values and the number of complexes that we have found that are being stabilized under different pH values. And you see that most of the complexes are more stable under slightly acidic conditions and under slightly basic conditions, but very few of them actually at what people think is the physiological pH in the cell. And this is actually in contrast to what people do, because if you screen the EMDB pH values, this is exactly with a peak at the pH 7.5, and doesn't reflect what we see in our analysis at all. And since we see that the pH is really the most important parameter in looking at stability and aggregation behavior, I think this is some concern that we should have. And so if you don't know anything about your complex and if you have no idea what's the best pH, slightly acidic pH is the better choice.
Have you measured zeta potentials for these complexes?
Sorry?
Have you measured zeta potentials for these complexes to look at what happens as you vary pH according to their solubility?
No. We don't have enough material for all these complexes that we have here in our hands. So some of them are really low abundant, and we just have enough material to run those studies. We get them, some of them we did on our own, some of them come from collaborators, and the only thing with what we have done is looked at different conditions under the EM, whether this, these differences we see are significant in the electron microscope.
It'd just be nice if, I mean, I guess there's practical limitations too, but if you could plot zeta potentials on top of this.
Yeah, we haven't done that. And I don't know the concentrations you need to measure the zeta potential.
Yeah,
I have no idea, because this is very, very low concentration.
Yeah.
Oh.
I guess the pH is also temperature dependent.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, it depends on the buffer systems are. Some of the buffer systems, they are pH dependent, and this is all considered in the software. So this is something we take into account.
Yeah. Holger, this is not criticism for the approach, but the parallelization I see is that, that of a crystallographer's approach, that basically you try several different buffers trying to see, what is going to enable crystallogenesis choices. But the advantage that we have to maintain as EM people is looking at more native complexes.
No, I don't agree at all. You need something you are capable to work with. So something that is structurally defined and stable. But you don't want to tell me that a broken complex is functional, even though that you think the buffer environment is what you think it might be in the cell.
That very much depends, because the high number of these complexes are actually very transient.
Yeah, but you have no idea about the local pH, the local environment, the local amount of small molecules in the cell. You have no idea, and you're trying to claim that. But when you take them out of the cell and you look at them in vitro and use any reduced buffer system, like everybody of us, you can't claim that native.
I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
What I disagree is that although classical biochemistry can be long and tedious, it's actually our departure from it that has created a lot of trouble, because you have to spend the time to understand your system and trying to reconstitute.
No, I mean, what you can also do is what we have also done for most of those complexes, or for some of those complexes, we have looked at the activity. So we have functional assays, and then we looked at them before the optimization and after the optimization. And some of them are more active, some of them not. But you can check it, you can tune it, you can learn from this what influences your complex in what way.
So
and you have to have some control of your complex. Sorry?
What usually happens with activity
at low? We don't have activity assays for all the complex, for none of them, for only a few of them. So it's, how many do we have, David? Two, three,
four?
Yeah, so four out of these 40, it's only 10%. So we can't. Yeah.
To the question. There's actually old papers, like,
and it's dependent on the partial CO2 pressure. Anyway.
Saying that, you know, people didn't try the other ones and now we will have millions of structures, but on the other side, you know, selection shows that the pH is not that one.
Yeah, but are we all happy with the structures? Are we all happy with the current resolutions that we have and all the conformational behavior and...
But
and
being happy with something is not a good way of jumping on, you know, to a different thing. But what I'm saying is, you know, maybe those are the easy ones to do with that pH, or maybe those are just...
I mean, if you're happy with, I don't want to tell you that you should work at any other pH of 7.5. We don't do that because it just doesn't give us good images. So, and I think I'm more concerned about structural integrity and whether they aggregate or not to be able to do reliable reconstructions than anything else. And the functional stuff comes later. So, and you can always play with that. So you can just tune the system and see what you can make more dynamic. To make the system more dynamic and more functional active is the easy thing. To make it more stable in the first place is the difficult thing. So, and one thing, I'd show you one example here. So here, this is a collaboration that we have started 1.5 years ago with Jürgen Markel in Mainz. And they came to us with the snail hemoglobin. And this is the... They work for decades on large hemoglobins and hemocyanins, and they didn't find anything special. So this was a normal buffer condition that they were using for all of their complexes they have used in the past. So they were never really depending much on buffer systems. So those are normally stable complexes. But the sample they came with was looking like that, and in our analysis it was looking like that, so not at all like it should be. And when we run the analysis, we rebuffered. The only buffer that came out to be really good was this buffer here. This is an imidazole buffer at pH 6, and then we were able even to hyperstabilize the whole complex. And by rebuffering this into that, we get already more kind of intact complexes. Not all of them are being repaired. But then if you do the purification again in this buffer, this is where you end up with when you work with that. So, and now, so this is the pH 7.5 buffer, or 6, I don't remember very well. This is at pH 6, Grossling. So now tell me what you would like to prefer to work with in the electron microscope, and whether you are interested in function or not.
what you want to do is you want to do both.
Yeah, obviously, yeah. Yeah, but you also want to understand why it looks different. So, and if you have no readout, there's no way to do that. So, okay, those can then be done. This can be done very quickly, actually. So you do this buffer optimization, this graphic stuff, and then we can get cryo images that are very nice. So all this can be done in a very short amount of time, and then the optimization is already being done within a few days or 2 weeks or so. So this is something that is really efficient. And and you start from here. One thing I also would like to add is, so this is the standard TRISP buffer system. Then we started to grow crystals again. If you use that, you will never get any crystals here. And we get crystals only and immediately, actually, if we work under those conditions. And I don't agree that crystal structures are not native. They have always something to do with the conformational space that is sampled by those complexes. So I don't think that this is a good assumption that we believe that X-ray structures have nothing to do with the native structures. Okay. So now we are working on that, but we haven't solved the structure yet, obviously.
So working in a large center, you have lots of biochemists come up to you and they want you to look at their protein.
Yeah.
And one thing that you usually want to avoid doing is using your microscope for screening to see whether
they
found conditions.
Yeah.
Can you correlate other assays, like the appearance of the complex on the STS-PH gel, with what it's going to look like?
That's the weakest readout you can have. So STS gel is really a weak readout. A better readout is a native gel. So that tells you a little more about the quality of your complex. But the SDS gel is really the weakest readout you can imagine. That's the most common scenario, is that the biochemist comes to you and gives you, oh, I have this wonderful gel, this must be a wonderful complex. And usually this is not true.
You would ask them to do a native gel before you use it again.
Yeah.
You
haven't
showed any native gels.
No, I haven't. Sorry, I haven't. Do you have on your poster a native gel? You haven't. Yeah, but we get, I mean, not some of them are very sharp and have some smearing, but you really get better native gels when you do that. Do you have some images with you, David? Yeah, so ask him. Yeah. Okay, what we also did is we used the technique for some of the complexes where there are crystals or where there have been crystal structures determined quite recently. And what you see is if you run this optimization system and what we see by the crystallization buffer that was successful in crystallization, that they match pretty well. So, and this is just all the complexes that where we have crystallographic data available, and they match very nicely with what we can measure in our optimization screen. So this is not a selection of some of the complexes that have been crystallized. This is all the complexes that, in our 37 systems that we have looked at, where crystals were available. And there we, with our screen, we find almost the same buffer conditions that people have used for crystallization. So, and I think to summarize it, what we do actually is, so you run the cell culture, you try to purify your complex, and then we do immediately these buffer optimizations. And so we always do that now very routinely. We don't even look at the complexes before we have done that, or we do it for controls, but that's the normal pathway. So we always go back, try to do the buffer optimization, go back into the purification scheme, use the new buffer system that we have found that should be more suitable, and then you can do that again. It's because you cannot make sure that everything has been good enough from the very beginning. So this can be one or two cycles. Then you can do the same screen. The first screen we do is buffer conditions, meaning pH and buffer systems. And once this has been optimized, then we do a ligand screen where we have a screen of small molecules which we use that have been seen in crystallography or any other techniques as some kind of stabilizing reagents. Also osmolytes that are very crucial for the stability of complexes are in this screen. And then we do that again. Once we are done with that, we can do the graphics. And we try to get these complexes with maximum stability, not considering any functional stuff. And then you can go to cryo-EM or even to X-ray. And that is at least the way we do it now. And this only looks at the structural heterogeneity. So even if you have optimized all that, there's still a lot of heterogeneity in terms of conformations. So you don't exclude those things at all. That there is a lot of conformational heterogeneity, and that is even temperature dependent. This is something we have looked at on the ribosome a few years ago. And if you you can see that here, that shows you the different degrees of the 30S body rotation in the ribosome if you freeze the ribosome at different temperatures. And you can clearly see if you work at lower temperatures, you have a certain conformation that becomes stabilized. But if you go to higher temperatures, the energy landscape is being modified. And this is not necessarily the same kind of stabilization for any complexes you work with, because some of these complexes are not really stabilized in a single conformeric state if you cool it down to 4 degrees. So what we try to do now is, and what we're currently working on is we see whether we can get a functional stabilization of those complexes by supercooling these gradients. So we have asked our service engineer to be able to cool the centrifuges down to -9 degrees, and then you can hopefully you can get a more stable conformeric state of your complex, and you can if you can cross-link that on the same run, then you will be able to stabilize a specific conformeric state of your complex, in addition to get the structural stabilization. And we also work with thermophiles, because this is a very general thing, and the conformeric behavior should also be different for thermophilic systems. So this is what I think I'm running over time already, right? So I try to acknowledge the people who have done this work. So Ashwin, he came up with the idea of using the thermofluor. David was doing all the theory and also did a lot of the experiments I've shown you. Jan Martin, he did the software. Niels was working on the ribosome. And those are the other members of the group who also do this kind of experiments. And I thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Holger. Are there any questions? There's one on the back there.
Yeah, this is the intermolecular cross-linking depends very much on how much material you add on your on the dupe. So, and if you stay below about 120 picomole of material, then you don't see any intermolecular cross-linking. And if you have a too high concentration, you can create dimers. Yeah, but as long as you stay below a certain concentration, you don't see that. And for most of the complexes, you're not running into this kind of trouble at all, because you simply don't have enough material for that you can add more than 120 picomoles. So at least the complexes I've shown you. It's hard to get more material in higher concentration.
So my question is, so I've actually used this method, and I really like this method a lot for graphics, is what I'm talking about. But say you're working with a new complex and you're not exactly sure what you're even looking for, what it's even supposed to look like. So you run your graphics and you get a bunch of fractions. How do you know which one is your complex and which one are just misfolded proteins or something like that?
Yeah, you see, if you have a normal complex, a really well-defined complex, then this profile of your gradient should be very narrow. If you have a profile in your gradient where the particles smear almost along the entire gradient, then you know that you have other sources of trouble that you cannot solve by this graphics fixation. And you will never be able to find the right spot where you should do your structural work on. It means that you have not the right environment for your system. It has been already some damage happened to your complex, and then you need to optimize it. But as soon as you have a clear profile, then it's not so easy, not so difficult anymore to find the right spot. And as you can always run a non-fixed and a fixed gradient in parallel, and then do the SDS chill of the non-fixed. And this should also give you, at least on an SDS chill, the profile of the proteins that you're looking for into your complex. Yeah, this is something we can also do, and you can screen whatever you want. So we have this ligand screen that you can add specific metal salts or whatever you can imagine. So you can think of any other thing you would like to test. So no, this is very very specific for each of the compounds. As I said, there's no real pattern that other than the pH region, where we saw any significant statistical relevant match of certain conditions better than others, and you need this or this salt. You see a certain trend, of course, if you, for example, for cadmium, zinc, those are really bad for almost all complex. So there's a certain set of metal ions that you really don't want to have in the proximity of any of the complexes. So this is something, on the negative side, there's some correlation, but not on the positive side.
Question here.
Yeah.
Oops.
Can I?
Go ahead, Hong.
Yeah.
Go.
So this is to follow up with this buffer selection. So in our hands, we consistently notice that the HIPAA buffer is very bad for CryoEM. Because when we use HIPAA buffer to freeze any sample in our hands, the ice is very strange. The consistency is strange. So I theorize that there's a phase of ice on the HIPAA buffer that is very high density. Okay, I don't know if anybody in the audience have noticed this problem. I think so. We never use that afterwards.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't seen, we use HIPAA for some of the systems we work with, and some of them are really stabilized in HIPAA buffer. So biochemically, it's not particularly bad buffer. So
I've never had any issues with HIPAA myself. Sorry. My question is about detergents. We oftentimes add detergents when we're preparing cryo, and this dye that you're using.
That doesn't work.
Okay.
Because then you have micelles.
Right, and this is what I'm assuming. So you can't screen detergents with
and
this.
And the CMC is temperature dependent, and you will create an extra signal that is difficult to correct. We've tried that, and for the improvement in staining when you do this graphics, the only explanation I have is that I mean, first of all, you that is very common. So you have also observed it or not? We always see that actually. So we always see that. We always see that in all of our complexes. Okay, you have no small things that lie around on the carbon film, which gives you already a better impression of how the particles look like. The other thing is that when you have this final purification in a gradient and you're really looking only for this fraction, you get rid of all the small molecule contamination, also detergents or anything that can interfere with heavy metal salt staining solutions. And that is a lot. So if you have traces of detergent present in and you try to do urinal formate or acetate staining, then you create background that you don't want to have. So you just have a pure sample and get rid of all the small molecule stuff that may interfere with the heavy metal salt.
So I'm sure many people have experienced this when you have the literature telling you some proteins should bind to your complex, and then you mix them together and they don't bind. And you never know if it's the literature that's rubbish or if it's the condition that's not right for the interaction or if the interaction is just too weak. I was wondering if you could use your thermofluor assay to kind of screen different conditions, if it's sensitive enough to detect whether you have a complex or not.
You can, if you see it, what we think is that you might be able to determine binding affinities of proteins to your complex, but we are not yet there, and I'm not sure whether this is sensitive enough to do this. But you see when you bind the protein and it does add to the stabilization, this is something you can see. But that is not the same like only binding.
I have a question related to the buffer optimization too. I'm wondering whether it is temperature dependent. For example, we prepare grids at 4 degrees or at 25 degrees or even higher. Does that matter what buffer you choose?
Not on the buffer, but on the conformation of flexibility of your complex, it does matter a lot whether you prepare that at 4 or 25 or 37 degrees. This has a huge influence on your system. The buffer, I mean, we haven't done that systematically to see what happens if you use different buffers at different temperatures for different complexes. Then you have, then it gets very difficult to analyze that systematically.
With the graphics, I was just wondering.
It's on.
Okay.
Have you done like a direct resolution comparison, like with the ribosome or something?
We haven't pushed the ribosome in the fixed state to high resolution, but what we did is an 11-12 angstrom map of the graphics treated one that looks the same like a non-treated one.
So basically, like 12 angstroms or something was that the limit of that?
No.
Based on the, because of the
no, I mean, if you can even crystallize some complexes when once they are graphics treated, and then there shouldn't be a limit why one should get very high resolution for any of these graphics treated complexes. I mean, you have just a number of glutaraldehydes that bind here or there. Not much.
Okay, I think we have to break for lunch. Let's thank both speakers this morning for a fantastic talk. Ifan, do you have a... Are you speaking? Okay. Okay, back at 1 o'clock, please.
That was great, thank you. Excellent.
Thanks.
Yeah, I heard some of that talk and...